listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
People think that someone's trying to demonize the black man. I mean, the rappers are the biggest thing in the black community. You're taught the thug mentality. And
this narrative of being dangerous, you get approached like you're not there to be protected. You're there to be subdued.
Melissa Hasley of Penn Valley Community College and attorney David Bell returned for another call-in show about race. That's Jaws of Justice Radio, Monday, 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
Support for 90.1 FM provided by Folk Alliance Music Fair Public Concerts. Three nights of music Thursday, February 19th through Saturday, February 21st at the Sheridan Crown Center Hotel. Music starts at 7 p.m. each evening with over 20 acts each night, including Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn, Sam Baker, Ray Wiley Hubbard, Red Volkert, The Stray Birds, Dom Flemons, Betsy and Clark, Curtis McMurtry, Sarah Morgan, Red Molly, The Howland Brothers, Howard Iceberg, and dozens more. Tickets are available at folk.org or in person at the Folk Store, 5th and Delaware.
I'm Michael Hoag. Monday on the Arts Magazine show, actor Kyle Hatley will be with us to talk about the Rep's new production of An Iliad.
Yeah, he's cursed to retell this story to a new civilization every time they need it to be told. In other words, wherever there is war, the story must be told.
Also, actors from the Unicorn production of The Lasso of Truth. That's Monday at noon, Arts Magazine show.
It may be cold outside, but Thursday, February 19th, The Pitch has an event to help warm you up on the inside. 90.1 FM is supported by Vodka Vodka, a night of food sampling from local eateries like 12 Baltimore and Grace's Best Cookies. Plus, of course, vodka from the Dark Horse Distillery and Smirnoff. For more information, call 816-561-6061. It's The Pitch's Vodka Vodka at the Monarch Event Space at 17th and McGee on Thursday, February 19th.
ideas. One is that information technology grows exponentially, and it turns out to be amazingly predictable. I mean, people say you can't predict the future. It turns out the exponential progression of information technology, and it's not just computation, it's things like genetic sequencing, brain scanning, anywhere you can measure the underlying information properties, grows at an exponential pace and amazingly predictable. I have a graph of the price performance of computers going back to 1890, the first automated American census. It's a very smooth, doubly exponential curve through 110 years, completely unperturbed by little things like two world wars, the Cold War, the Great Depression, and all the other history that we experienced. Genetic sequencing has doubled every year since the project was announced. And exponential growth is surprising because you start out doubling little numbers, it looks like not much is happening, and then it becomes quite explosive. If I take 30 steps linearly, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I get to 30. If I take 30 steps exponentially, 2, 4, 8, 16, I get to a billion. Ultimately, it makes a huge difference. Intelligence inherently predicts the future, but our built-in intelligence, what's hardwired, is linear thinking. We think in a linear manner. That worked very well 1,000 years ago when we saw something coming at us through the corner of our eye. We would make a linear prediction about where that animal would be, and that served our purposes quite well. And that intuition has survived to the present time. And even very sophisticated thinkers, when they're thinking about the future, let's say like a brain scientist who I debated recently, who's studying one ion channel in a dendrite and did the mental experiment of, well, how long would it take me to reverse engineer the whole brain using today's tools and today's supercomputers and today's scanners? And he came up with the conclusion this would be centuries. What he failed to take into consideration is that the tools, the scanning, the computers, everything is doubling in power every year. These tools will be 1,000 times more powerful in 10 years. So exponential growth of information technology, it's not just Moore's Law, it's not just computers, it's anywhere we can measure the information technology, and ultimately that's quite explosive. And this is not just looking forward, because I've been making these predictions for 30 years. When I was a student at MIT, we all shared one computer, took up half a building. The computer in your cell phone today is a million times more affordable. It's a million times cheaper, 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in price performance that we've already experienced. It's 100,000 times smaller. And what used to take up a building now fits in your pocket. What fits in your pocket today will fit inside a blood cell 25 years from now, and the price performance will again be a billion times more powerful because even the rate of exponential growth is speeding up. So that's the first idea underlying the singularity. The second is that we will capture human intelligence in a machine, and I've been very consistent that the date for that is 2029. Long before that, we will have computers that are powerful enough to simulate all the regions of the human brain at very low cost. And that's pretty much a mainstream view now. What is perhaps more controversial is, okay, we'll have the hardware, but what about the software? Isn't that stuck in the mud? And I go to extensive lengths in the singularities near to point out that that is also progressing at an exponential pace. 10, 15 years ago, many artificial intelligence applications were just experiments. Today, they permeate our economic infrastructure. Every time you send an email or connect a cell phone call, intelligent algorithms route the information, pick up any product. It was designed with intelligent computer-assisted design software, inventory levels controlled by intelligent just-in-time inventory systems assembled in robotic factories, get a electrocardiogram, it comes back with an automated diagnosis that rivals that of doctors, same for blood cell images, intelligent algorithms, fly and land airplanes, guide intelligent weapon systems, automatically detect credit card fraud, and I can mention 100 other applications of intelligent software doing tasks that used to be done by human intelligence and are now doing them just as well by artificial intelligence. And you can say, okay, well, these are narrow examples of AI, and it's narrow AI, but the narrowness is gradually getting broader. And what's underlying this is that we are making exponential progress in understanding the best example we have of human intelligence, which is the human brain itself, and it's not hidden from us. And there again, we're making very smooth, very predictable, exponential progress. The spatial resolution of brain scanning is doubling every year. The amount of data we're getting is doubling every year. And we're showing that we can turn this data into working models and simulations of brain regions. There's already 20 regions of the brain that have been modeled and simulated, like the auditory cortex, the visual cortex, the cerebellum, where we do our skill formation, like catching a fly ball, slices of the cerebral cortex, where we do our abstract reasoning. And the scale, the sophistication, the detail of these simulations is scaling up at an exponential pace. And I make the case in Chapter 4 of Singularity is Near that we will have the models and simulations of all the regions of the brain within 20 years, and that'll provide the software for human intelligence. Once we capture human-level intelligence in a machine, that'll be a very important threshold. First of all, it's not, in my view, just artificial intelligence to compete with us and displace us. We are going to use it to extend and expand who we are. We're going to merge with this technology. It's already in our pockets. Ultimately, it'll make its way into our bodies and brains. If I were to say, well, someday you'll have millions of intelligent blood cell-sized devices in your bloodstream keeping you healthy from inside, going inside your brain and interacting with your brain, putting you on the internet and expanding your intelligence, you'd say, well, it sounds kind of futuristic. And I'd point out there's already dozens of experiments of a first generation of nano-engineered blood cell-sized devices that are keeping animals healthy in experiments. One scientist cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a blood cell-sized device, 7-nanometer pores, lets insulin out in a controlled fashion. At MIT, they have a blood cell-sized device that can detect cancer cells based on the antigens on their surface, latch onto them and destroy them, and there are dozens of other experiments like that. You could put a computer in your brain today if you're a Parkinson's patient, and it will replace the biological neurons destroyed by that disease. The latest generation now allows you to download new software to the computer inside your brain from outside the patient, and that's an FDA-approved therapy. And if you look at what we can do today, that neural implant is not blood cell size, it's pea size, but it will be 100,000 times smaller in 25 years and will be the size of a blood cell and will be a lot more sophisticated. So once we get to that threshold, artificial intelligence working together with our biological intelligence will be able to solve problems, design even more intelligent AI, and with the law of accelerating returns will continue to make the hardware devices more powerful. And when you get to the 2040s, the portion of our civilization's intelligence that's amplified by artificial intelligence will be a billion times greater than the biological intelligence that gave rise to all of this. So in other words, the human civilization will expand its intelligence a billionfold because of the ongoing exponential explosion of intelligence from developing the artificial form of it. And that's such a profound transformation that it's hard to see past the horizon of that. So we use a metaphor from physics where a singularity in physics, a black hole, has an event horizon around it that's hard to see beyond because none of the information can easily get out in a classical sense. However, in physics, we can use our intelligence to talk about what life is like beyond the event horizon of a black hole, even though we can't easily see beyond it. And we can similarly do that today, talk about what life will be like past this event horizon, even though it's profoundly transformative. And what we can say about it is we're going to amplify our intelligence, and intelligence is the facility we have that enables us to solve problems. All the major problems we have as a society, whether it's the environment or energy or health and disease, we use our intelligence to overcome those problems, and we already use our machine intelligence to help us with that. There isn't any scientific engineering or even mathematical work, even work in the arts like music and graphic art that isn't amplified by using our computerized tools. And as these tools get more intelligent and more powerful, we're going to continue to expand our reach. That's what human beings do. And ultimately, the singularity represents a billionfold increase in the intelligence we'll have to apply to these problems.
You will will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Deport from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Where are we headed in 2015? According to a recent poll conducted by the AP, apparently 48% of Americans believe that 2015 will be a better year than 2014 was, while only 11% think it's going to be worse. Is this vague optimism realistic? Does it take into account the events unfolding around the world right now? Let's take a look at our current trajectory. The war in Ukraine isn't over. Relations between the U.S. and Russia are more tense than they've been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. The stakes are getting higher in each round. Kiev has put their so-called anti-terrorist operations in eastern Ukraine mostly on hold for the winter, though shelling has continued. And they've engaged the separatists in peace talks. But many believe that this is just a ploy to give them time to regroup and rearm, with some help from Washington. These aren't just empty suspicions. In December, the Ukrainian government announced their intention to double the military budget and conscript 40,000 new soldiers for an offensive against the east. Also, the U.S. government is moving to supply the Ukrainian government with more weapons and training over the next year. When such an offensive would kick off is uncertain, but we'll be watching events in the region closely as spring approaches. One of the most important signals heading into 2015 was the Ukrainian government's decision to annul their non-aligned status with NATO. This doesn't mean that NATO membership would be granted right away, but it is a sign that they intend to make a bid. Why is this dangerous? Because the NATO agreement compels each of its members to defend all other members militarily if attacked. And we saw how Washington's Muppets in Kiev claimed that they were being invaded by Russia over and over throughout 2014. No evidence was provided or demanded. The U.S. government and their lapdogs in the media were perfectly happy to take these claims at face value and repeat them constantly as if they were established facts. If Ukraine becomes a NATO member, these claims could trigger military deployments. Considering the fact that this is a scenario that NATO is actively preparing for, this has to be taken seriously. We can't talk about the showdown with Russia without looking at the dramatic drop in oil prices that began in 2014. Obviously, there are conflicting narratives on this topic, But according to The Guardian and Salon, in September of 2014, John Kerry instructed the Saudis to raise production and to cut its crude price. Now, the Saudis have indicated that they have no intention of slowing down oil production anytime soon. But the elephant in the room here is U.S. oil production from fracking, which has been dramatically ratcheted up as well. This move might seem absurd since it's going to hurt U.S. oil producers, but it's clearly going to hurt Washington's key opponents, namely Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, far more since these economies are far less diversified. Drop in oil prices has already had a massive impact on the value of the ruble. And combined with the sanctions, there's a good chance that the Russian economic situation could degrade even more in the coming year. The drop in the ruble has also interfered with Russia's efforts to establish trade agreements which bypass the dollar. With the ruble going through bouts of hyperinflation, even their closest allies are hesitant to accept payments in rubles. You'll hear people like CFR member Ian Bremmer describe Russia as a dangerous, wounded beast that may do something unpredictable. It's like a teenager poking a bear with a sharp stick and then warning that the bear might bite. Yes, the bear might bite, so stop poking it. The conflict in Syria isn't going away. In fact, 2014 was the most deadly year on record, with some 76,000 people killed. U.S. airstrikes will continue in 2015, but they won't destroy ISIS or even weaken it significantly.
Well, first of all, because they're such an insignificant amount, it's not an air campaign, Greg. People have got to understand these are just hitting three targets a day, maybe a five. We just are not using air power.
Though ISIS established its position with the help of U.S. arms and funding, at this point they seem to have procured their own revenue streams through taxation and oil sales. In the long run, this makes them a liability. But in the short term, ISIS is doing most of Washington's dirty work by weakening Assad. The Syrian government will most likely continue to slowly weaken throughout 2015. We could, however, see some surprises that completely alter the playing field. For example, ISIS might make good on their threats to attack targets in the West. Remember, the group did get a hold of 88 pounds of uranium in Iraq this past summer. In December of 2014, ISIS announced that not only have they built dirty bombs with this material, but that they have already smuggled them into Europe. Now, dirty bombs aren't all that deadly, but people don't need to be in any real danger in order to panic. An event like this would put a full-fledged invasion of Syria on the table, and it would obviously be used to justify an even greater expansion of surveillance and police powers. Watch the covert origins of ISIS for more information on this topic. The Ebola story has obviously dropped off the mainstream radar, but it didn't go away in the real world. The chart is still moving in the same direction, up. Sierra Leone has dramatically escalated their containment effort, but according to the Red Cross, the number of cases has in fact spiked in recent weeks, and the situation is far from being under control. The virus is now mutating as fast or faster than a seasonal flu. So every day that it remains active in West Africa increases the chances of a game-changing adaptation. Until Ebola is completely eradicated, it remains a dangerous wild card heading into 2015. Watch Ebola Fear, Lies, and the Evidence for more information on this topic. Heading into 2015, race relations in the U.S. are a gas can waiting for a match. You can't predict the kinds of events that act as sparks, but we've seen from 2014 that the threshold for outrage and violence is getting lower. This trend isn't likely to reverse in the coming year. The danger on this front heading into 2015 isn't so much physical, but rather that it could deepen divisions and make it totally impossible to unify the people against their common enemy. Who benefits from that scenario? In the realm of politics, as a lame duck president, Obama himself is a wild card. 2015 presents a window of opportunity to push through unpopular policies before the media starts hyping the 2016 elections. The fact that Obama has nothing to lose in 2015 is likely to factor in on issues like the TPP, which Obama says he intends to support in spite of resistance from the left. He also supports the TTIP, which is slated for a renewed push in 2015 as well. His agreements contain provisions which would hand even more power to multinational corporations and implement SOPA and CISPA through backdoor channels. The only reason we know anything about these treaties is from leaked drafts. The negotiations are being conducted in secret, and the final versions could end up being much worse. Future isn't set in stone, at least until the concrete dries.
Well,
every choice we make influences the world around us, sometimes in ways we couldn't even begin to imagine. So let's go into 2015 with our eyes open and make the best of what comes.
If this message resonates with you, spread it.
If you want more, subscribe to Storm Clouds Gathering on YouTube or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. If you have a topic request, post it in the comments. And for the full transcript and sources, visit our website, stormcloudsgathering.com.
said, brother, can I borrow a thin, brother, you know, dime? Say, sis. I sure like to have this whole dime for me so I can get this cup of coffee. Cop me a snack or something. I guess I better quit trying to be hip and get on down. Yeah, man, like, you know.
Journalist accused of working with the hacking group Anonymous has been sentenced to 5 years in prison in order to pay nearly $900,000 in restitution and fines. Barrett Brown, held in custody since September 2012, pleaded guilty to charges of transmitting threats, accessory to a cyber attack, and obstruction of justice for interfering with the execution of a search warrant. After his sentencing on Thursday, Brown released a satirical statement saying, quote, good news, the U.S. government decided today that because I did such a good job investigating the cyber industrial complex, they're now going to send me to investigate the prison industrial complex.
Before Barrett Brown's path crossed with the FBI, he frequently contributed to Vanity Fair, The Huffington Post, The Guardian, and other news outlets. In 2009, Barrett Brown created Project PM, which was, quote, dedicated to investigating private government contractors working in the secretive fields of cybersecurity, intelligence, and surveillance. He was particularly interested in the documents leaked by WikiLeaks and Anonymous. In the documentary We Are Legion, Barrett Brown explains the importance of information obtained by hackers.
Some of the most important things that have been have had the most far-reaching influence and have been the most important in terms of what's been discovered, not just by Anonymous, but by the media in the aftermath, is a result of hacking. That information can't be obtained by the traditional journalistic process, or it can't be obtained or won't be obtained by a congressional committee or a federal oversight committee. For the most part, that information has to be, you know, obtained by hackers.
In In 2011, the group Anonymous hacked into the computer system of the private security firm H.B. Gary Federal and disclosed thousands of internal emails. Barrett Brown has not been accused of being involved in the hack itself, but he did read and analyze the documents, eventually crowdsourcing the effort through the Project PM. One of the first things he discovered was a plan to tarnish the reputations of WikiLeaks and sympathetic journalist Glenn Greenwald, then with The Guardian. Brown similarly analyzed and wrote about the millions of internal company emails from Stratfor Global Intelligence that were leaked on Christmas Eve 2011. Shortly thereafter, the FBI acquired a warrant for his laptop and the authority to seize any information from his communications, or in journalism parlance, his sources. In September 2012, armed agents barged into Brown's apartment in Dallas, Texas, handcuffed him face down on the floor. He has been in prison ever since.
For more on the sentencing of Barrett Brown, we go to Dallas, Texas, to speak with Kevin Gallagher, the director of the Free Barrett Brown Support Network. He attended Brown's sentencing hearing on Thursday. Kevin Gallagher is a writer, activist, systems administrator, currently working for Freedom of the Press Foundation. He recently wrote a piece for the New York Observer called "Don't Believe What the Government Says About Barrett Brown." Kevin Gallagher, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about who Barrett Brown is, the sentencing yesterday, and what it means for freedom of the press, and talk about just what he did.
Certainly. Well, thank you for having me on, Amy. So, as you provided in that very good background there, Barrett Brown is a journalist activist who became known through his work with Anonymous, and he landed on the radar of the FBI through his investigations of the private intelligence contracting industry. His case has gone on for over 2 years now, and his sentencing was delayed several times. Finally, yesterday, in the second half of the sentencing hearing, the judge imposed a sentence. It was really quite extraordinary because the judge essentially agreed with the government on most of the sentencing enhancements which they had proposed, overruling the defense's objections. He did not seem to understand what the public impact of this case would be. He dismissed out of hand the mitigating factors of Brown's mental state when he made the videos. In fact, he was more concerned about the chilling effects on FBI agents in conducting their investigations than any chilling effects on journalists who paste links. I think any journalist in the United States should be concerned about the precedent that this sets for people who share information, people who report on hacking, or those who use hackers as sources, or who do computer security research and things of that nature. But even just anyone who shares a link without knowing what exactly is in it, they've set an unreasonable expectation here that you should know that for certain that the link you're sharing doesn't contain stolen credit cards or things of that nature before doing so.
And what is the importance of the information that he provided about Stratfor? Who is Stratfor Intelligence and its role?
Well, yes, Stratfor is a private intelligence firm. They're much like a private version of the CIA. They have do global analysis and conduct generate reports which people subscribe to and receive these reports. As a result of the emails that were leaked to WikiLeaks, there's several things came out of there. They were conducting surveillance of Occupy Wall Street, going after activists in Bhopal, India, and even targeting PETA at the best of Coca-Cola. Brown actually did most of his work on the H.B. Gary emails and looking at things like persona management and the Team Themis scandal, which he mentioned, more than he had a chance really to look into Stratfor.
I wanted to go to that issue of H.B. Gary. By analyzing the information from the H.B. Gary hack, Barrett Brown discovered the security firm's plan to undermine journalist Glenn Greenwald's defense of WikiLeaks. One slide read, "Without the support of people like Glenn, WikiLeaks would fold. H.B. Gary intended to spread disinformation to discredit both Glenn Greenwald and WikiLeaks." In the documentary We're Legion, the director spoke to former H.B. Gary CEO Aaron Barr about these plans.
It seems like you're trying to attack a journalist here.
Yeah, and I don't want to talk too much more about Glenn Greenwald, but other than, you know, what I previously said is, you know, there was never an intent to attack journalists. not on my part. I would never just outwardly attack a journalist, other than if I felt that there was a journalist in my mind that was acting unethically, that, you know, that is fair game for having a public discussion about.
That's former HB Gary CEO Aaron Barr in the documentary We Are Legion. Of course, Glenn Greenwald would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize. Kevin Gallagher, the significance of what Barrett Brown did in relation to HB Gary, and as we wrap up, what the sentencing says to people in this country.
Well, it says that they should be very concerned about the state of press freedom in this country. The U.S. has dropped in their ranking on press freedom, as told by Reporters Without Borders, in fact, due to this case specifically. As far as HB Gary, one of the biggest things that Brown found in there was a program called Romas Coin, which was this mobile phone application proposal to target the Arab world. And, you know, this to me, this is on par with any report that you've seen from the Snowden documents. And this was discovered 2 years before Snowden even came forward.
And that sentencing, he will spend how long in jail?
Well, he's been sentenced to 63 months, which is the maximum under the guidelines which the judge calculated according to the offense levels. But he could be out within 1 or 2 years if he completes an in-prison drug rehab program. And, you know, the bottom line is this is not going to deter him from doing his work, which is writing, making people laugh through his hilarious column and investigating government wrongdoing.
Well, Kevin Gallagher, we want to thank you for joining us. Writer, activist, and systems administrator, currently working for Freedom of the Press Foundation, also director of the Free Barrett Brown, a support network advocacy group and legal defense fund. Yes, Kevin Gallagher attended Brown's sentencing hearing on Thursday in Dallas. This is Democracy Now. When we come back, a major decision from the Supreme Court this week on whistleblowers. Stay with us.
Vsauce. Michael here. Love and war are exactly alike. It is lawful to use tricks and sleights to obtain a desired end. But is all fair in love and war? That's a good question. Let's pencil it in for, well, this episode. Of course, pencil is not permanent. It can be erased. It's not like whatever I write down is being chiseled into granite. But pencil lead is made out of carbon atoms organized into a structure called graphite, a non-metallic mineral with some metallic properties found naturally in rocks, which means things written in pencil, though erasable, are still technically written in stone. In video games, if the bad guys really wanted to stop you, why do they walk around in such predictable patterns? Wouldn't their chances be better if they just came right at you? There's a great name for this logic. Mook chivalry. It's as if there's a sort of unwritten Geneva Convention that applies to fictional baddies that respects not reality or what would make sense, but instead the higher purpose of fun and a good story. But in real life, we aren't that much different from the mooks. We construct voluntary obstacles in the way of even honorable goals like truth, justice, or right over wrong. Not all is fair in love and war, and it's the exceptions that make us who we are. Torturing your enemies to get information from them, to demoralize them, or just for fun, has been a might is right part of war since war began. But in the second half of the 19th century, Henri Dunant, the founder of the Red Cross, organized an official moral code of warfare, the Geneva Conventions, that today, across its now four conventions, has been agreed to be followed by 196 nations. And since then, various other customs, codes, and principles have been established, totaling up into what may now be called the rules of war. Their enforcement is handled by regional, national, and international powers. Of course, an unconcerned force would simply ignore these rules, because the quickest route to victory is the one full of unfair advantages. But nonetheless, we treasure them, try to at least, and believe that all others should. The values they recognize are telling. Things unrelated to military necessity, or valued, in a sense, more greatly than immediate victory, are protected. For instance, the Environmental Modification Convention prohibits controlling the weather and using the weather as a weapon against your opponents. Before the convention, that happened. For example, during Operation Popeye, U.S. airplanes seeded rain clouds over Vietnam and successfully extended the monsoon season by more than a month, increasing rainfall by 30%, a move that made enemy road surfaces muddy, blocked by landslides, washed out, much less passable. The laws of war protect certain symbols. Parties or infrastructures bearing symbols that indicate they're only there to help or are neutral. Culturally important buildings that should be protected for posterity are off limits. It's a violation of the laws of war to attack such targets or to pretend to be such targets if your intentions are otherwise. That is called perfidy, a kind of deception that involves pretending to act fairly and honestly, to invite the confidence of an adversary, only to then take advantage of that trust, betray it, and kill, injure, or capture. If you do one of those three things while pretending to be dead, or injured, or surrendered, or a civilian, or a non-combatant, well, that's a violation of the rules of war. Espionage is allowed, but if caught, you can be prosecuted and punished. Whereas if you are a lawful combatant, on the other hand, you're entitled to protection as an official prisoner of war. Conditions like these reveal something we desire to hold above quick vengeance, dignity, and respect. Both sides wish to be treated with that and uphold the bargain. Athletes agree to play fair, to avoid prohibited things, even
technically safe and otherwise legal things that would nonetheless give them an unfair advantage. They do this because the spirit of the sport is more important to them than the quickest victory possible. Sportsmanship. Likewise, a sort of lovesmanship exists in U.S. courtrooms. If the most surefire way of getting the truth of someone's guilt involves spoiling a bond of love, spousal privilege says, chill. Love is sacred. Truth will come second. Find another way. So, if you are planning on committing crimes in the U.S. and you need an accomplice, marry them. Your spouse cannot be forced to testify against you. There are different privileges applying to other relations of yours, allowing them to refuse to give evidence against you. These rules exist to honor something that we deem, or like to deem, greater than easy victory. You cannot travel faster than light, or escape from a black hole, or commit perfidy in a time of war, or cheat on your significant other. That's usually considered unfair. But the final two aren't physical limitations of matter. They are voluntary obstacles reflecting what we value. Whether we respect those values or not is another story, and how we interpret what actions are over the line and what aren't is a matter of judgment. We didn't get to create protons or planets. They were already here. But we do get to create judgments. We even named ourselves after that ability. We call ourselves Homo sapiens. Homo meaning humus, the soil. We are from the earth. Sapien meaning sapience, the ability to make wise judgments. Very few people would argue that all truly is fair in love and war, but in love and war, behaviors otherwise not acceptable can be not only forgiven, but recommended. Reading messages not meant for yourself, using disguises, even murder can be downgraded to a crime of passion or lawful combat. But love and war put different things at stake. And just because unfair things are expected during love and war doesn't mean that within their respective domains we prosecute or prohibit unfairness in the same way. Violating the law of war is a crime, but there is no official law of love. You can prosecute someone for perfidy or desertion or weaponizing the weather, but you can't prosecute Cupid for heartbreak. You can't have someone arrested for not loving you back, and you shouldn't call 911 if someone leaves you for someone else. You see, there is no Geneva Convention for love. Furthermore, we often root for friends or fictional characters who follow their hearts, even if it means leaving someone we care less for, a minor character, for instance, alone or stranded at the altar. Does this mean that love is a better excuse for bad behavior than war? I mean, obviously not for criminal behavior, but otherwise? As far as authoritative powers and our modern conception of love are concerned, war, its technologies and strategies, are human invention. Whereas love is a human condition. Love is like inertia or death, inevitable, a law of nature, and blameless if unkind. We legislate where a bomb can fall, where debris can fall, and prosecute those who violate those rulings. But we don't prosecute gravity for making things fall. We support voluntary restrictions on fair play in sports, war, public etiquette. But the players in love's battlefield are blameless victims of their passion, even if those passions are nonsensical. The heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing of. Deceiving others, that is what the world calls a romance. Maybe love has this power intrinsically, or maybe we give it that power by leaving it so legally alone. But either way, broken bones are the domain of law. Broken hearts are the domain of awe. Shucks. Sorry. And as always, for watching.
Standing without places, rotation into phases,
all packing things. You're not going no place. Let me tell you something right here now.
You're my girl.
Everybody sing.
You're my girl.
I don't wanna discuss it. There ain't no need to check it. I don't wanna discuss it. Cause I know just where you're at. Now listen, baby.
You're my girl.
Everybody sing.
You're my girl.
And baby, that's that.
Ooh, baby, that's that.
Don't wanna talk about it. Cause I know what you're gonna say.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City.
Ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. I'm the best ever. There's never been anybody ruthless. There's no one that can match me. My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable. And I'm just ferocious. I want your heart. I want to eat his children. Praise be to Allah.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3,